All right, it's the top of the hour, and it's time for obituaries. We have 6 printed obituaries today. First, we have Deacon Larry Brown Fencing. Deacon Larry Brown went home to be with the Lord on October 20th, 2021. Died peacefully at home, surrounded by his wife and daughter. He succumbed from Parkinson's and complications from norovirus. Funeral services will be held at 1 p.m. Saturday, November 13th, at Maple Street Missionary Baptist Church. Visitation at the funeral home will be held Friday from 12 to 7 p.m., with family in attendance starting at 5 p.m. Deacon Brown worked with his brothers to build Brown Brothers Fencing in 1971. In 1995, he and his wife, Minister Judith Brown, established Larry Brown Fencing. He later worked for Hy-Vee in the floral department and contracted for Des Moines Steel. Deacon Brown was a member of Maple Street Missionary Baptist Church for over 35 years and was ordained as a deacon 30 years ago. A quiet man, Deacon Larry loved and helped his church in any way he could. He loved spending time with his grandchildren and led a simple life. He also loved horses. He leaves to mourn his passing, his wife of 50 years, Minister Judith Brown, his children, Reverend Kelvin and spouse Anita, federal and state meat inspector, lieutenant with the Des Moines Police Department, Kenneth and spouse Yolanda, United States Airlines pilot and artist, Leonard and spouse Raquel, and SFC Army retired Quanda Brown, 5 grandchildren, siblings Elise M. Hostin, Wilma Ross, and Willie Brown, along with a host of church family and friends. Donations may be directed to the family. From Des Moines, Larry L. Aitz, 88, died November 10th, 2021. A memorial mass will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, November 13th, at St. Joseph Catholic Church, followed by urn burial at Highland Memorial Gardens Cemetery. Larry was born September 30th, 1933, to parents Harley and Maureen Aitz in Kirksville, Missouri. His family moved to Fort Madison, Iowa in 1942, where he graduated from high school in 1953. He served in the U.S. Army Engineers, attached to the Air Force in Anchorage, Alaska. In 1957, he married Rose Ann Lamp of West Point, Iowa. He spent his career working for the railroads. He was very proud of his family. Larry was preceded in death by his son Rick Aitz, parents and 2 siblings, Louise Barden and Dwight K. Aitz. He is survived by his wife of 64 years, Roseanne, 3 sons, Randy and Rodney of Des Moines and Craig of Indianola, 1 daughter, Linda Lawson of Grand Prairie, Texas, 5 grandchildren, 3 great-grandchildren, and sister Carolyn Steffenmeyer of West Des Moines. Contributions may be made to Every Step Hospice. For more information, you can go to islescares.com. Also from Des Moines, Joan Louise Maust, age 91, of Des Moines, Iowa, passed away peacefully, surrounded by her family, on November 9, 2021. Joan is preceded in death by her first husband, John E. Maust, Jr., her brother Joseph Puchalski III, and her parents Joseph Puchalski Jr. and Pauline Puchalski of Scranton, Pennsylvania. Joan was a loving wife, mother, and grandmother. She is survived by her husband, Edwin Gibson, her 2 sons, Doug Maust and Blair Maust, 2 stepsons, Scott Gibson and Mark Gibson, her sister, Charlotte Kramer, 4 grandchildren, Logan Maust, John Maust, Josh Maust, Becky West, 4 step-grandchildren, Trevor Gibson, Mackenzie Gibson, Meredith Botus, Spencer Gibson, and 3 great-grandchildren. Joan graduated from the Pennsylvania State University in a in accounting and worked for Pierce Waterhouse, Russ Kaysen, and the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. She was a long-standing member of St. Andrew's Episcopal Church in Des Moines and was a Scout Den Mother, active with quilt groups, investment clubs, and Penn State Alumni Club. She was also a fan of all things Disney. A memorial service for Joan will be held at St. Andrew's Episcopal Church, the address 5720 Urbandale Avenue, Iowa, on Saturday, November 13th at noon. The family will receive visitors just prior to the service, however. Due to COVID, protocols there will not be a visitation. Memorial gifts may be sent to St. Andrew's Episcopal Church or the charity of your choice. Dale?
From Valeria, Paul Joseph Fork, age 52, passed away on Thursday, November 4th, at his home in Valeria. The son of Jerome, or Jerry, and Wilma Fork, maiden name Shaffron, Paul was born on October 18th, 1969, in Jefferson City, Missouri. He moved to Colfax in 1975 and graduated from Colfax Mingo High School in 1988. He married Tina Wade in 1991, and together they raised their three children, Cherry, Beth, and TJ, or Bubba. Paul was remarried in 2021 to Kathy, maiden name Warwick, Fork. They quickly fell in love and never wanted to spend time apart. Their relationship was filled with so much laughter, adventure, and love. The special bond they shared was evident to all those around them. Throughout Paul's life, he was employed with Vermeer, Davies Tree Service, Wright Tree Service, and the City of Des Moines. Paul was an incredibly hardworking and dedicated arborist. Paul also continued his father's legacy as the second generation owner and operator of Fork's Tree Service with his son, TJ. He took great pride in the work he did and loved to help others while also doing what he did best. Paul was an avid sports fan and enjoyed fishing, hunting, bowling, camping, and playing with his beloved bloodhound, Belle. He treasured the time he spent with his children, grandchildren, and dear friends. He loved to treat his family with his famous no-bake cookies. Everyone who knew Paul was touched by his kindness and humor. He could light up a room with his vibrant and outgoing personality. Paul loved being a prankster and brought much laughter to those around him. He was incredibly caring and generous. He would gladly give the shirt off his back to help someone in need. Preceding Paul in death were his parents, Jerry and Wilma Fork. Those left to honor his memory include his wife, Kathy Fork, son, TJ Fork, and spouse, Kyria, daughters, Beth Fork and spouse, Dustin Coder, and Sherry Foreman and spouse Adam, stepdaughter Mindy Dunleavy, spouse Ben, siblings Michelle Fork, Tim Fork, Patrick Fork and spouse Tony, and Matt Fork and spouse Chris, mother-in-law Karen Clark, grandchildren Shauna, Caleb, Carson, Leslie, and Colt, step-grandchild Gabby, as well as many nieces, nephews, and friends. A celebration of life will be held on Sunday, November 21st at 2 p.m. at the Colfax Historical Center, located at 500 North Walnut Street in Colfax. Guests are encouraged to wear any Kansas City Chiefs or Forks Tree Service attire in his honor. Condolences may be left for the family at www.coburnfuneralhomes.com. From Ames, Brian Lee Vandewater, age 70, passed away while surrounded by family at Mary Greeley Medical Center on November 8th. Visitation for Brian Vandewater is from 2 to 4 p.m. on Sunday, November 14th at Grandin Funeral and Cremation Care, located at 414 Lincoln Way in Ames. Funeral service is at 11 a.m. on Monday, November 15th at Heartland Baptist Church, located at 3333 Stang Road in Ames. A family burial will take place at the Hebron Cemetery in Adair County. A full obituary may be found at www.grandinfuneralandcremationcare.com. And from Indianola, Delmer Calbus. Funeral services for Delmer Carl Calbus, age 89, who passed away Wednesday, November 10th in Indianola, will be held at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, November 16th at the Fairview Community Church, located at 19705 U.S. Highway 69 in Indianola, with burial following in the Indianola IOOF Memorial Garden Cemetery. Visitation will be held from 9 to 10:30 a.m. prior to the service at the church. Delmer is survived by his children, Debbie Weeks, Carla Harrell, spouse Terry, Connie Calbus, Kevin Calbus, spouse Denise, 9 grandchildren, 10 great-grandchildren, brother Jim Culnett, spouse Karen, Gary Culnett and spouse Linda, sister Sylvia Akin, and many nieces and nephews. He is preceded in death by his wife, Martha, his wife, Shirley, his son, Doug, his brother, Ray Culnett. Memorials may be given in his name to Fairview Community Church. To sign an online condolence, visit our website at www.overtonfunerals.com.
All right, that concludes the obituaries for today. I'm going to read an article from the sports section here. Up first from columnist Randy Peterson, Kolar, tough, focused, passionate, on and off field. Charlie Kolar wasn't around Tuesday to defend himself, but that's all right. From his coach and teammates, their comments were more than enough to show that when you mess with Iowa State's All-American tight end, you're in for a tussle. Out of the national spotlight, Chuck, as Iowa State coach Matt Campbell and teammates call him, is aggressive, passionate, and focused on being the best Chuck that he can be. Whether that's playing pickleball on Campbell's driveway or playing pool against a teammate in the football players' lounge, if things don't go well, let's let quarterback Brock Purdy take this one. Charlie loves competing in little games, Purdy said. Sometimes it's annoying to play against him in whatever you're doing, like board games or in the players' lounge playing pool. Only the team is allowed in that part of the football facility, so we'll take the Purdy's word for it. But it isn't surprising Kolar is competitive. That probably dates to his high school days in Norman, Oklahoma, when Kolar was a basketball teammate with now NBA star Trae Young. You better be at your best when you're playing with the best. I love that he was an athletic football player who played multiple sports and was competitive in everything he did, Campbell said shortly after getting Kolar's national letter of intent in 2016. Campbell has seen that on the field. If I can find the rest of my article here. All right, let's start that sentence over again. Campbell has seen that on the field, where Kolar continues his standout career at 2:30 p.m. Saturday at Texas Tech. Last summer, Campbell was even more of Kolar. Last summer, Campbell was even part of Kolar's competitiveness while playing pickleball in his driveway. Let's let Campbell take this one. I'd like to roast Charlie for a while right now because I know he gives me a lot when he's up here, Campbell said, addressing reports on the podium. But for Charlie, what is so impressive about Chuck is he's as high end of a competitor as I've been around. My favorite story is it's him and Greg Eisworth playing me and Mike Rose in pickleball in my driveway, Campbell continued. Now I'm undefeated, so I'm going to state that right now. We get down to the last point, and you would think we were literally 4-1 in the 1 yard line. Now, remember, we won, me and Mike. We beat them. Make sure that makes the story. But Chuck's reaction for an hour was he was so mad and he wanted to play another round. We weren't playing another round because I won. That was it. True story, per Rose. Charlie struggles with losing, one of the nation's top linebackers said. He's beginning a little better, but whether it's pool or pickleball or anything, you have to tell him to grow up a little bit sometimes. Kolar is a senior. He's a preseason All-American. He's the best tight end in Iowa State history. And yes, he's as competitive as they come. Charlie loves to compete, and sometimes it's annoying to play against him, like he's broken a couple pool sticks and thrown a cue ball after losing, Purdy said. It's fun, though. It's good. Kolar is a national finalist for the Campbell Trophy, which honors college football's best scholar athletes. He's got a 3.99 grade point average in mechanical engineering. He's competitive there, too. He's so competitive that he's everybody's rival, offensive coordinator and former Cyclone tight end coach Tom Manning said. Everybody has something to win. A couple years ago, when I coached tight ends, I let him know that, hey, Charlie, you're certainly more intelligent than me and everything, but I know more than you know about this specific thing, which is football. Manning took that into account when coming up with a trivia contest between Kolar and former Iowa State assistant coach Alec Golsich. We rigged the trivia game, Manning said. We basically gave Golish all the answers before we went in. We rigged the trivia game, which really made Charlie mad. That's the beauty of Kolar, a great tight end who detests coming out second best. The moral of the story is, he's an elite competitor, Campbell said. Whatever Charlie puts his mind to, he's really successful and he wants to be the best. If it's school, he wants to be the best. If it's on the football field, he wants to be the best. If it's in the weight room, he wants to be the best. That's what's really impressive to me. When he goes after something, he's all in and he's doing everything in his power to be the best. Other than at pickleball.
Thanks, Maddie. I'll read another story from the sports page. This one is about women's college basketball, written by Tommy Birch. The title is Drake's Dinnebier Ready for Spotlight. After securing the first win of her head coaching career, Drake's Allison Pullman walked into the locker room at the Knapp Center and was greeted by her entire team. The Bulldogs celebrated her victory by cheering and dousing her with water. Head to toe, Pullman said, smiling. The 82-79 victory over Creighton was an exciting debut for Pullman. The longtime Drake assistant coach took over the program when Jenny Baranchik left for Oklahoma. The Bulldogs kicked off a new era with a big win. Katie Dinnebier, a freshman from Waukee, hit a three-pointer with 3 seconds remaining to give the Bulldogs a season-opening victory. Dinnebier finished with 9 points, while fellow freshman Anna Miller added team-high 17 points. Drake needed every one of them after letting a 17-point second-half lead disappear following a 14-0 run by Creighton in the third quarter. Creighton tied the score at 79-79 on a three-pointer by Morgan Maley with 27 seconds remaining in the fourth quarter. That set the stage for Dinnebier, who took a pass from Allie Wooldridge and knocked down the game-winning basket. I saw my defender fall to the floor, and I just knew that I had to get a shot up, had to get something with time running down, Dinnebier said. Some takeaways from Wednesday's game. There are high hopes for Dinnebier now that she's at Drake. She is expected to play a big role for the Bulldogs this season. Just one game into her college career, she already has. Dinnebier had the 9 points, 4 rebounds, and 1 assist. But the biggest moment came in the fourth quarter. Shortly after Creighton tied the score, Pullman put the ball in the hands of Dinnebier. Dinnebier drove to the lane but couldn't find anywhere to go, so she fired off a pass to Wooldridge, who passed it back out to Dinnebier. The freshman then knocked down the big shot. The moment wasn't too big for Dinnebier, who proved to be a clutch performer as Waukee won a state championship last season. I honestly think, and I think we all know this, That's going to be the first of many glimpses of Katie Dinnebier we see at the end of games, Pullman said. The Bulldogs couldn't get any stops in the third quarter. It led to the 17-point lead disappearing as Creighton knocked down a barrage of three-pointers and went on a 14-0 run to cut Drake's lead to two. Creighton struggled with its shooting in the first half, then took advantage of some mismatches after halftime, and Drake was slow to recover. The Blue Jays shot 40.3%, which was 14 for 39 in the game, from the field for the game, and got right back into it thanks to the third quarter success. We just didn't adjust, Pullman said. We were a little bit slower with our rotations. The natural tendency is to really cover the paint, and then out when what we needed to do with this team was really cover out, and then the paint. Okay, the tendency is to really cover the paint and then out, when what we needed to do with this team was really cover out and then the paint. Okay, that's basketball speak, which I am very unfamiliar with, apparently. The freshman from Minnesota got her college career off to, we're talking about Anna Miller now, who was impressive. The freshman from Minnesota got her college career off to a strong start. Miller scored 17 points and grabbed 5 rebounds, most of that damage coming in the first half. She was efficient as well, shooting 8 of 14 from the field. Miller averaged 20 points and 12.8 rebounds per game as a high school senior. It won't always be smooth sailing, but Miller showed that she could have a promising college career. She's only begun to touch her potential, Pullman said. And finally, Bulldogs are still a force on offense. Pullman will add her own touches to the program, but she's made sure to keep Drake's fast-paced offense. The Bulldogs didn't appear to miss a beat. They shot 49.2% from the field and 44.4% from three-point range. Layups and three-pointers have been the calling card of the Bulldogs' offense in recent years, and Wednesday night was no different. Drake tallied 46 points in the paint and focused its attention on high percentage shots in the lane, particularly in the first half. The three-point shooting will likely pick up as the season goes along, but Drake's offense appears to be in a good spot.
All right, and now for a story on Iowa, Iowa football. Iowa's Taylor on pace for obscure punting record. This comes from columnist Chad Listicow of the Register. Iowa's 14th-ranked football team is taking the punting is winning mantra to the extreme. Even though the Hawkeyes have an impressive 7-2 record, punter Troy Taylor is tied with Illinois' Blake Hayes for the Big Ten Conference lead, with 58 punts. But Hayes has played 10 games. Taylor has played 9. That's a Big Ten high of 6.4 punts per game for the Hawkeyes, 24-year-old Australian punter. Only 3 players in FBS, Aaron Rodriguez of New Mexico with 61 punts, Mason Hunt of Southern Mississippi with 60, and Harrison Smith of Vanderbilt with 59, have attempted more punts, but they're punting for teams with a combined 6-21 record. Taylor punts for a team contending for a Big Ten Conference championship, with the Hawkeyes entering their final 3 games in a 4-way tie for the West Division lead. Of course, frequent punting is frequent punting is an indictment in Iowa's 123rd rank offensive. But Taylor's statistics, a 45.8-yard average with 28 downed inside the 20-yard line, have made punting a good reason, typically for the Hawkeyes. I'll tell Troy all the time that I feel like he's the best punter in the country, Iowa Special Teams coordinator LeVar Woods said Wednesday. I don't think I'm misspeaking when I say that. I know where there are some people that are punting in different elements, different conditions, not much wind, altitude changes. You see some of the gaudy numbers from different conferences, but if you're punting in the Big Ten, the wind changes from quarter to quarter in our conference. You watch Troy between TV breaks go out there to check. Has the wind changed? Has it adjusted? Those are not easy things to do for a punter or kicker. It's like playing golf. Your shot gets changed. Taylor was instrumental in the Hawkeyes' two biggest wins of the season. He was the National Special Teams Player of the Week after his 51.1 yard average on 8 punts in a 27-17 win at then number 9 Iowa State on September 11. A 69-yard punt that day flipped the field and the game. Then, on October 9th, in a 23-20 win against number 4 Penn State, 6 of Taylor's 9 punts were downed at the Natty Lions 6-3-12-1-8-8 yard lines. A strong argument could be made that Iowa doesn't win either of those games without Taylor's bombing leg or directional prowess. And now, Taylor finds himself on pace to set a dubious yet impressive record, with 2,655 total punt yards this season. The reigning Big Ten punter of the year needs 879 more to surpass the school record, 3,533 accumulated by Ryan Donahoe in Iowa's forgettable 2007 season with a record of 6-6. Donahoe used 86 punts that year to get there with a 41.1 yard average. Taylor would need to average 44 yards over his next 20 punts to set Iowa's school record. Iowa is guaranteed at least 4 more games this season, counting a bowl. Woods has no idea such a record existed or was in reach. Taylor probably didn't either. It's reflective of the volume of punts a team negative and the distance at which he's punting each try, an individual positive. Taylor has become a celebrity of sorts in Iowa. He is wildly popular among Hawkeye fans. He partnered with Raygun to raise money for charity on sales of a Punting is Winning t-shirt with his name and jersey number 9 on the back. Woods said he is careful to monitor Taylor's workload in practice, considering he's asked to punt a lot on Saturdays. I always look at the average and the net. Never even thought about looking at the total yardage, Woods said Wednesday. Whatever happens with Troy happens in regard to the season. I feel good about the way he's practiced. He had a great practice yesterday, and he had another great practice today. Dale?
Thanks, Maddie. And I'll do one more sports, maybe, for this one to let you know what happened in the high school football playoffs yesterday. The story's written by Cody Goodwin. West Hancock, Grundy Center win semifinals. Iowa High School football's Class A state championship game is set, and it features two familiar foes, West Hancock with a 12-0 record and Grundy Center with an 11-1 record, won the Class A semifinal games on Thursday at the Uni Dome in Cedar Falls. West Hancock topped East Buchanan 37-0, and Grundy Center beat Woodbury Central 28-7. As such, the undefeated Eagles and the Spartans will play in next week's Class A title game. This will be Grundy Center's third straight trip to the Class A final. West Hancock will be playing for its third ever state title, and its first since 2019, when the Eagles beat Grundy Center 21-17. Kickoff is set for 1 p.m. on Thursday at the Uni Dome. West Hancock kept its undefeated season alive thanks to its stellar defense and a heavy dose of Matthew Francis. The Eagle defense pitched its fifth shutout of the game against an East Buchanan team with a 10-2 record that had averaged 27.8 per game this season. West Hancock allowed 226 total yards and only allowed the Bucks to enter the red zone once. The offense, meanwhile, was paced by Matthew Francis, who rushed 25 times for 129 yards and 3 touchdowns, giving him 1,804 rushing yards and 28 touchdowns on the season. Ryland Barnes scored the other 2 touchdowns on a 36-yard pass from Mitchell Smith in the first quarter, then on a 43-yard pick 6 in the fourth quarter. Grundy Center arrived at its 11th win of the season thanks to big plays from Logan Knack and Dane Zinkula, and an opportunistic defense. Woodbury Central actually outgained Grundy Center 273 to 256 yards in total offense. What plagued the Wildcats was turnovers, 3 in total, and 2 empty red zone trips. In the first quarter, Woodbury Central had 4th and goal from Grundy Center's 3-yard line. The Wildcats committed back-to-back false starts to back up to the 13, then threw incomplete on 4th down. In the second, Woodbury Central had 3rd and 8 from Grundy Center's 17, but Zinkula took an interception back 88 yards for a touchdown. That gave Grundy Center a 14-0 halftime lead. The Spartans doubled their point total in the third quarter thanks to 2 touchdowns from Knack, one passing, another rushing. He finished with 3 total, and Zinkula added the pick 6 and 120 rushing yards.
All right, I have moved over to the Iowa Life section, and we have a story here about the Prairie Art Festival. Annual Art on the Prairie Festival returns Saturday and Sunday in Perry. This is from Allison Ullman of the USA Today Network and Prairie Chief. After moving to a virtual format in 2020, Art on the Prairie is returning to an in-person festival Saturday and Sunday in downtown Perry. I think artists are excited. The community is excited. The Art on the Prairie group is excited, said Art on the Prairie Board President Mary Rose Nichols. We just are glad to have the opportunity to see all the art on display in Perry and the vibrancy in music and visual arts all combined. We're just glad to have it back. The annual festival moved online in 2020 because of COVID-19 concerns. While Nichols was happy they were still able to support artists through the virtual format, she is looking forward to seeing them in person this year. Just seeing Perry full of people wandering from building to building in the downtown and experiencing the wonderful art in each and the music, Nichols said. Perry just comes to life the weekend of Art on the Prairie. Just really excited to bring back the artists and the musicians and look forward to having it be a big weekend for the community, added Art on the Prairie Board Vice President Lindsay Pasuti. Around 40 visual artists and 30 musicians will be located in 7 buildings in downtown Perry: Security Bank Building, Hotel Patty, Town Craft Building, Carnegie Library Museum, Perry Public Library, Betsy Peterson Design, and La Poste, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Saturday and 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Sunday. While no poetry readings will be held this year, the Perry Public Library will feature local artist displays and youth activities, as well as a visit from the Iowa Historical Society of Iowa's Mobile Museum. The library will host 3 children's concerts with songwriter and artist Chad Elliott at 10:30 a.m. and 1:30 p.m. Saturday and 1 p.m. Sunday. Elliott will perform songs from his children's book, Wilderman's Treetop Tales, during the concerts. Artwork from his book is also on display at the library. Nichols is looking forward to Elliott's performance, adding that it is for all ages and a great family activity. This year's featured artists include Jennifer Drinkwater of Ames and Betsy Peterson of Perry, who was selected as the 2019 People's Choice winner. Peterson will have her work on display in her gallery, Betsy Peterson's Designs. Drinkwater's work will be featured in the cellar at La Poste. She will display pieces from the What's Good project, which combines storytelling and visual art to highlight what's good in various communities. In addition to the featured artists, the two-day festival will also bring around 40 artists and 30 musicians from across the state to Perry. Nichols said while the number of artists is a bit lower than in years past, the Art on the Prairie committee wanted to allow more space between booths in each building for social distancing. While the annual festival draws a number of shoppers from around the state and beyond, Pasuti encourages local residents to come check out the art on display throughout the downtown area. Nichols also reminds local and out-of-town shoppers to stop in the three galleries downtown, Atelier at 1109, Mary Rose Collection and Betsy Peterson Designs, as well as visit the shops and restaurants in Perry. I just really hope that people get out and about and check it out. Enjoy this festival that we're bringing to the community. Don't forget to take advantage of the wonderful things we have in our community, Pasuti said. For more information, including schedule of events on the Art on the Prairie website and Facebook page.
Thanks, Maddie. Also from the Life section is the CMA Awards. In case you missed it, the Country Music Awards were on Wednesday. Chris Stapleton takes 6 awards. Combs wins top prize. The story written by Andrew Dalton and Kristen M. Hall of the Associated Press. And the dateline for the story is Nashville, Tennessee, appropriately. Chris Stapleton was the big winner with 6 trophies, including Song and Album of the Year. And Luke Combs claimed the biggest prize with Entertainer of the Year at the Country Music Association Awards on Wednesday night. Stapleton won Male Vocalist of the Year and Song and Single of the Year for Starting Over, and Album of the Year for his record of the same name. He walked away with 2 more trophies as a producer on the single and album. He then won Male Vocalist of the Year for the 5th time, and it appeared he would sweep the night before Combs swooped in and kept it from becoming a coronation. I don't deserve to win it, an emotional Combs said as he accepted the Entertainer of the Year trophy from Alan Jackson, but I'm sure as hell glad that I did. At times, it seemed Stapleton, who also performed twice, was on the stage all night. Man, amazing, the soft-spoken singer with the long beard, never one for speeches, said after he won his last award. I'm running out of words. He came into the night the top nominee along with Eric Church, who was shut out. Along with Stapleton and Church, Combs beat out Carrie Underwood and Miranda Lambert, who opened the ABC telecast with a medley of her hits, including Kerosene, Mama's Broken Heart, and Gunpowder and Lead. It was a night of big emotions for many winners. The brothers Osborne won Vocal Duo of the Year for the 4th time. Lead singer T.J. Osborne, who came out as gay this year, appeared to be holding back tears as he accepted. It's been a roller coaster of a year, especially for me emotionally and for you all, and for you all to support me. It's been incredible, he said from the stage. Alan was openly tearful as he became the 2nd black performer to win New Artist of the Year. I want to thank my father, who's no longer with us, for introducing me to country music, Alan said. He recalled spending the last of his money to be able to see pioneering black country artist Charlie Pride at the CMAs in 2016, then getting to perform with Pride on last year's show. Pride died of COVID-19 a month later. Darius Rucker, in 2009, was the 1st black artist to win the award. Old Dominion won Vocal Group of the Year for the fourth straight time. Carly Pierce wept as she won Female Vocalist of the Year for the first time. Pierce, competing in an all-female category, was the only woman to take the stage and claim an award during the ceremony, now in its 55th year. Gabby Barrett was the night's most nominated woman with 4 nods, but the American Idol alum was shut out. The ceremony represented a return to normal for the show. It was back in front of an audience at its usual home, the Bridgestone Arena in Nashville, Tennessee, after last year's ceremony was held at a crowd-free Music City Center because of the coronavirus pandemic. "We're following all the health protocols to keep everyone safe," host Luke Bryan said during his opening monologue. "And we're all vaccinated," he said. "Or not?" asking the awkwardly laughing audience, "Anyone?" Moments later, he was joined on stage by his American Idol co-host Lionel Richie and Katy Perry, who sneaked up on him from behind. "I have hosted other awards shows," Brian told his Idol co-hosts, pretending to be surprised. "I can handle this myself." Perry answered, "Yeah, we've seen them. That's why we're here." Then they helped him present the first award to Stapleton. The CMAs are always heavy on performances, and this year was no exception, with more songs than awards. Church was surrounded by flames on the stage as he belted out "Heart on Fire." Pierce and Ashley McBride then took the stage for a duet of "Never Wanted to Be That Girl." Underwood and Jason Aldean duetted on their current hit, "If I Didn't Love You," and real-life friends Kane Brown and Chris Young sang their hit duet, "Famous Friends," which was nominated in 3 categories but failed to take an award. In winning Album of the Year, Stapleton beat nominees including Morgan Wallen, who was caught earlier this year yelling a racial slur. The CMA Board of Directors disqualified Wallen from individual awards, but he could still win for his work. Wallen, who was not in attendance, got the biggest cheer by far of all the album nominees from the arena crowd. Had he won, it would have come during a show that featured diversity and inclusiveness in country music. In addition to the speeches by Allen and Osbourne, who also brought up his sexuality during the duo's performance, Stapleton joined Jennifer Hudson to pay tribute to Aretha Franklin and the country songs she recorded, with a rousing gospel-style rendition of Willie Nelson's Nightlife.
All right, from USA Today Money section. Survey: many U.S. workers hope to stay remote after pandemic. This comes from Terry Collins. Nearly 50% of workers in the U.S. say they would take up to a 5% pay cut to continue to work remotely, at least part-time, post-pandemic, according to a new survey. About 25% surveyed also say they would quit their jobs if they couldn't work remotely. And about 70% say they've found attending virtual meetings far less stressful than being in an office alongside their colleagues. Those are just some of the interesting findings in a poll of more than 2,000 full-time workers in the 5th annual State of Remote Work conducted by OWL Labs and Global Workplace Analysis and shared exclusively with USA Today. The survey comes as nearly 1 in 4 Americans working in a remote or hybrid setting continue to do their jobs amidst COVID-19 and during what experts cite as a great resignation cycle. In August, a record 4.3 million U.S. workers quit their jobs, compared to 10.4 million job openings, often at higher pay. The Labor Department reported many for COVID-19 related reasons, including the ability to not work at the office. The mass job openings are currently giving workers an advantage who are now looking for significant compensation healthcare benefits, great technology to work with, both in and out of the office, said Frank Weishaupt, Owl Lab CEO. The data is very clear from this perspective that worker flexibility is here to stay, and companies need to start thinking with a remote-first mentality, Weishaupt said. Going forward, it will almost always be the case that at least one person will be in your meeting on a screen. Of those surveyed who mainly worked from home during the pandemic, 73% have returned to the office for at least one day a week, with 25% of those workers returning since September, Weishaupt said. The survey also showed more than half say they prefer to work from home full-time, and 91% say they are at the same productivity level or higher compared to working in the office. And 74% say working from home would make them happier post-pandemic, as a quarter of those surveyed say they will quit their jobs if they can't work remotely, with Gen Z representing the largest age group. Of those surveyed who changed jobs during the pandemic or were seeking new opportunities, 90% say they want a better career. About 88% want a better work-life balance, and 87% want lower stress. About 84% of workers say they want more flexibility in where they work, and 82% want more flexibility in when they work. Also, 64% of workers who worked from home say their top preferred meeting preference is a hybrid video conference call. It's the technology that saved us during the pandemic, said Katie Lister, the president of Global Workplace Analysts. We now see that workers can be just as productive in a hybrid environment compared to the perception that they wouldn't be in an office. Lister said the virtual meetings have proven beneficial for investors and beneficial for introverts and minorities who may have been more hesitant to speak during in-person gatherings. It's just clear that when we think about work, there's no going back to the way things were, Lister said. Despite the new mindset, Lister said about 38% of workers surveyed said their employer had upgraded their video technology to allow for more hybrid collaboration, as nearly 40% of their employers want employees back in the office. Still, only 30% of workers want to be. Also, the survey said that 73% of employees who also return to the office at least one day a week, millennials represent the most significant percentage at 60%, followed by Generation X at 25%, baby boomers at 8%, and Generation Z at 7%. Gen Z is the lowest because the younger workers are more eager to go back to the office to interact with their colleagues. Lister said they might not have the living space compared with their older, more experienced colleagues. The office is the center of their social life and well-being, Lister said. But young workers who prefer remote working are fleeing from their office, according to the survey. Workers between the ages of 26 and 40 account for two-thirds of moving from urban to suburban areas. The survey noted that about 63% of that age group also moved urban to rural areas, and more than half from suburban to rural locations. Also, 56% of workers say they would be interested in implementing virtual reality and holograms into their new work lives. Weishaupt said these workers want to take advantage of the so-called metaverse, an online virtual world incorporating virtual and augmented reality, video, 3D holographic avatars, and other not yet created forms of technology. And for those who prefer remote work, 55% say they work more hours. About 30% of men and 21% of women reported working two or more extra hours per day. That's the double-edged sword, Lister said. Overworking has always been a problem with working remotely or from home, as it can be really hard to turn off at the end of the day. We still need to learn how to set those boundaries to manage our time and energy better, because it's not good for the worker or the company, Lister added. For others, remote working has given employees a better work-life balance and more autonomy instead of a traditional 9-to-5 workday, Weispout said. He appreciates not always having to make a 3-hour commute to work 5 days a week. I can give that time back to work, spending time with my family, or my own physical and mental health, Weispout said. I'll happily take that trade-off.
Thanks, Maddie. I think I have time for a Moneyline story or two before we get to Dear Abby. Boeing reaches deal in 737 MAX Ethiopia crash. Boeing has reached an agreement with the families of the victims of a March 2019 crash in Ethiopia of one of its 737 MAX aircraft that claimed 157 lives. In the agreement, Boeing accepted responsibility for Ethiopian Airways Flight 302 losing control shortly after takeoff from Addis Ababa Bole International Airport. There were no survivors. In court documents filed Wednesday in federal court in Chicago, the company said its software was to blame for ET-302's loss of control and destruction, and that the 737 MAX was in an unsafe condition to fly. The agreement does not involve monetary compensation to the families as of Wednesday, according to court records, but allows victims' families to pursue claims in U.S. courts. And I guess I'll go ahead and get to Dear Abby now. The headline for today's column reads, "Man's house has become a homeless addict's safe space." The letter says, "Dear Abby, I have an acquaintance I've known for 10 years. He is homeless and a heroin addict. His addiction has gotten worse over the last year, and it is really bad now. He shows up at my home at all times of the night, sleeps on my porch, and leaves wet, dirty clothes behind. He comes over high on heroin, nods out, and acts very strange. I feed him, let him shower, and even buy him clothes from the resale shops, but I need this all to stop," in capital letters. "He continually needs something, money for cigarettes, a ride to here or there, clothes. I am a 65-year-old semi-retired man, and I do not want or need a homeless heroin addict in my life in my remaining days on this planet. I have tried repeatedly to end this, quote, friendship, but he doesn't have anyone. When I tell him to leave me alone, he breaks down and cries. It breaks my heart. When we first met, he was a happy, friendly, handsome person, but now it's horrible. He's sickly and looks bad. I even considered selling my home and moving. What can I do to finally get rid of this guy for good? Signed, Desperate in Florida." Abby replies, "Dear Desperate, by now you should have realized that you can't fix what's wrong with this person. In fact, you have become his enabler. Tell him you have done everything you can, but it hasn't helped him straighten his life around. Offer to help him find a drug rehabilitation program. Then tell him that until he demonstrates a willingness to help himself, you do not want to see him again. If he shows up stoned after that, rather than give him showers, money, and clothing, call the police and have him removed from your property."
All right, and I'll do a weather recap here. Today's high will be a 37, and the low for this evening will be 28. Be cloudy and windy today with rain or snow showers in spots, winds from the west northwest at 20 to 30 miles per hour, and mostly cloudy this evening. So if you're going outside, bundle up. And that concludes the reading of the Des Moines Register for Friday, November 12th, 2021. I'm Maddie Ryan, and my partner at the microphone has been Dale Finnegan. Earlier, you heard our first shift morning readers of Dave Buzik and Judith Linden. You can access IRIS programs on any computer, smartphone, mobile device, or smart speaker, like the Amazon Echo or Google Home. If you would like to learn more, just give us a call at 243-6833 or toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 1-877-404-4747 or check out our website, iowaradioreading.org. A special thanks to our broadcast partners, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and our music partner, bensound.com. Most of all, thank you to listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service. And have a great and wonderful weekend.